Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in the book of Exodus, chapter 2. I'm going to cover the entire chapter, verses 1 through 25. I will entitle this section, Moses is Born and Flees to Midian. Our context is this. In the first chapter of Exodus, a new Pharaoh arises after Joseph. That was about 200 years or so later. Enslaves Israel. Israel, in the meanwhile, having grown to a mighty nation with a population so large that the Pharaoh got frightened and tried to, and did successfully enslave them and make them slaves. So the Hebrews are slaves, and Moses is going to be born here in chapter 2. So we start in verses 1 through 4 of chapter 2. Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket and covered it over with tar and pitch. Then she put the child into it and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. Now this man, this Levite man, married a Levite woman, the daughter of Levi. Who are they? Well, most people, as John Gill, Adam Clark, and Jameson Fawcett and Brown say, Aram was the father and Jochebed the mother. The NIV suggest, however, that this was an unknown man and woman. They say, quote, there is some reason to believe that Amram and Jochebed were not the immediate parents, but the ancestors of Aaron and Moses. Amram must not have been Moses' father, and the Hebrew word for bore here must have the same meaning it has in Genesis 10, was the father of. So, according to the NIV Study Bible, it should be the woman conceived and was the mother of a son, or something like that. Now, the NIV Study Bible goes into a complicated bunch of genealogical explorations, which I'm not going to go into, which I actually have not taken the time to master. I think it's just as easy to go ahead and take the parents of Moses as Jochim and Amram, Amram the father, Jochebed the mother, because that's what most everybody does. But I will mention it just to show you that it might be possibly that that's not the case. Now, the son that was born was beautiful. This son was of the tribe of Levi because his mother and father were Levites. It's appropriate, says Adam Clark, that the lawgiver Moses and the high priest Aaron came from Levi because that was the priestly tribe that was to administer the law. The child was beautiful. That fact is noted by Stephen's recounting of the history of Israel in Acts 7:20. It was at this time that Moses was born and he was lovely in the sight of God. He was lovely. Hebrews 11:23 says this, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. Now, why is this little detail that Moses was beautiful? Why is it necessary for the narrative? As Adam Clark says, it's because if he hadn't been beautiful, he probably wouldn't have been rescued by royalty, because beauty by the ancients was regarded as a mark of divine favor. I have a little trouble with this because all babies to me look sort of the same. You know, the heads, a lot of times the heads pointed up like a cone and they all kind of reddish with all that mucus all over them. Of course, he wouldn't be a newborn. He was 3 months old when he was put in the basket. But at 3 months, you know, I guess some babies would be cuter than another, but I wouldn't think he'd be that much more beautiful. Maybe the baby was just strikingly handsome even at 3 months old. But at any rate, he was beautiful. When she could hide him no longer. Why couldn't Moses have been hidden longer than 3 months? Well, it could be that the Pharaoh's officers went on 3 month rounds, that they made a diligent search every 3 months, and it was time for another search, and there Jochebed would be there nursing that 3 month old baby. She couldn't do that. Now, the rabbis, according to John Gill, say that Moses was born prematurely, and Jochebed kept the baby until what would have been the end of a 9 month pregnancy. And after that, people begin saying, where's that baby? You're supposed to be having a baby now. What happened to it? Well, I don't think that's necessary. I think it's just easy to say that the baby was born for 3 months and the Pharaoh's officers were getting ready to look, because people begin wondering where the baby was, according to the rabbis, so she had to get rid of him. Well, why would the Hebrews want to worry about that? Why would the Hebrews want to turn their fellow Hebrew mother into the Pharaoh's? Maybe they were bought off. Maybe they were scared. Maybe they were being pressured, and so they would put Jochebed and Amram at risk. I don't know. That's all speculation. But for whatever reason, she decided that the baby's getting too big. The bad guys, their oppressors, their slave masters, Pharaoh's going to find out about it. So she had to hide the baby. So she puts him in a basket. That was a wicker basket. Interestingly, the word, that Hebrew word here in the text, it's of Egyptian origin, and it's used only here and also to describe Noah's ark. So this basket was actually in the shape of an ark. The basket was covered with tar and pitch, and you wonder, what's the difference between tar and pitch? That sounds sort of redundant. KJV has slime and pitch, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that first word shouldn't really be tar, but it's the mud of the Nile, which was hardened to form a caulk, so it would be mud and pitch. That makes a lot of sense to me, because that would keep that little ark of Noah, excuse me, ark of Moses, little boat of Moses, watertight very easily. Now, what was Jochebed thinking when she put Moses into that basket into the water? Was she just possessed of sheer naked faith because she was in desperation? Did she have no plan? She just said, I've got to get rid of the baby. I'll put him in the water and worry about what happens next. Hebrews 11:23 says, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents. That means Jochebed and Amram had faith because they saw he was a beautiful child and that they were not afraid of the king's edict. So they believed that God somehow would rescue the baby, and we can contemplate now how terrible that must have been for Moses' mother to put her son, this is her only son, well, actually, it's not her only son. She had Aaron. Aaron was older. But she had this son that she's trying to save, and she has to put him on a boat in a river. Well, that's option number one. She just did it in sheer desperation without a plan, but I don't think so. John Gill says that Jochebed hoped that someone would see and pick the baby up, and I think that's exactly right. In fact, I think they planned the whole thing. I think that Jochebed put that basket next to the Pharaoh's bath, or the Pharaoh's daughter's bath, which was probably a stone bath that was built out into the Nile, because Pharaoh's daughters aren't going to be walking through the mud straight out into a river. They're going to have a bath prepared for them. And so Jochebed figures, well, she's going to see this baby and she's going to want to adopt it. That still required faith, though, because she didn't know that was going to happen and she had to give her baby up. Adam Clark agrees with that view. He says that Jochebed probably picked a place where she knew the princess regularly bathed. Now, Jochebed put the basket amongst the reeds of the Nile, and that doing that kept the river current from washing the basket away. Now, in verse 4, the text states that Moses' sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. So, again, Jochebed just didn't chunk the baby out into the river. I mean, she had, assuming this is Miriam, and I do, Miriam standing there watching to see what's going to happen to the baby. So I think this was all plotted out. And Jochebed said, told Miriam, as soon as you see the Pharaoh's daughter, take the baby, come back and tell me. Now, I said it was Miriam. There's no slam dunk evidence that it was Miriam. GotQuestions.org says this was likely Moses' sister Miriam, the prophetess, and I think it is, but it's not 100% proven. There might have been another sister. We know one of Moses' sister was named Miriam because we know Aaron is Moses' brother, and Aaron's sister was named Miriam in Exodus 15:20. Miriam, the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took the timbrel in her hand. Now, there's some options as to how old she was upon hiding Moses at that time. John Gill says she was about 7 to 12 years old. Adam Clark says 10 to 12 years old. In a website called Women of Noble Character in the Bible, Women of Noble Character, it's a Christian site, says that she was about 5 years old. Let's just say she was about 10. Usually you see the pictures, and that impresses us so much, you know, but I've seen the pictures, she looked like she was 19 or 20, but I don't think so. Then she's probably about 10 years old. Well, again, this is all speculation. We go to Exodus 2, verses 5 through 9. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the Nile, with her maidens walking alongside the Nile. And she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid, and she brought it to her. When she opened it, she saw the child. That's when the daughter of Pharaoh opened it. She saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying, as well he might be. And she had pity on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Then his sister, that's Miriam, said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women that she may nurse the child for you? Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go ahead. So the girl went and called the child's mother, that's Jochebed. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give him, and I will give you your wages. Pharaoh's daughter said to the mother, that would be Jochebed, I will give you your wages, Jochebed. I'll pay you to nurse this baby. So the woman took the child and nursed him. Now, who is this Pharaoh's daughter? Again, nobody knows. One of my commentators, whose name I failed to record, says this is perhaps the famous 18th dynasty princess who later became Queen Hatshepsut. Well, that'd be nice because this Hatshepsut is one famous queen. She was basically empress, really. I've listened to the story of her on Egyptian podcasts for a while until I thought, boy, if it were possible, I'd like to read her autobiography. Of course, they don't have autobiographies of Egyptians. Excuse me, not just autobiographies, but biographies. They really don't have biographies of Egyptians either, but she was mentioned so much, and she is so famous, that wouldn't that be nice? But we don't know that. This is just speculation. So she will remain unnamed. We will call her the daughter of Pharaoh. As I said earlier, when she bathed there, she probably had a bath constructed there because it's hardly to be thought that an Egyptian princess would bathe in an open river, as John Gill says. Now, we're assuming when she's bathing, she's taking a bath, but there are some other options as to what she was doing. Option one, or there are some options. Option one, she could have just been doing religious ablutions, just washing her face and hands as she worshipped her Egyptian god, thanking the Nile itself, thanking the river without whose floodings Egypt could not exist. This is Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, Adam Clark's suggestion. Or it could be she was just bathing her body, which is what I think she was doing. Third option, she could be washing her clothes, because the text itself doesn't say she was bathing herself, it just says she was washing. Well, she could have been washing herself, or she could have been washing her clothes. But let's just assume she was taking a bath. She had some maidens with her. The NIV Study Bible said these maidens would bathe the princess in the Nile because, you know, a princess, she's not going to go to such proletarian task as picking up a bar of soap and rubbing it on her delicate skin. She has to have other people bathing her the way royalty did. One of them saw the basket. One of the maidens went and picked the basket up, brought it to her, and the Pharaoh's daughter opened the basket. Now, why does she need to open the basket? I thought the basket was open and the baby was just floating in the water. No, the basket must have been covered with holes in it for air, as John Gill says, because Pharaoh's daughter had to open it. Now, she looked in and she said, this must be one of the Hebrew's slaves. Now, how did she know the baby was a Hebrew? Well, John Gill gives three possible solutions for that. She might have thought, oh, this is a Hebrew slave because my father, the Pharaoh, has decreed death for all the male sons of the Hebrews, and this baby is out here exposed, so it must be they are killing the baby because of what my father Pharaoh's son, they're scared of the edict of death, and so they're trying to hide the baby. Option number two as to how she knew is that the Hebrews had lighter complexions than Egyptians, according to John Gill. If you look at the monuments, the Egyptians tended to be reddish brown. The Hebrews, I'm sure, I don't know this for a fact, but I'm sure they were swarthy, olive-skinned like Italians, kind of. I wonder whether you could tell the difference in a three-month-old baby. I don't know. Seems kind of unlikely to me. Option number three is the Hebrews were circumcised and the Egyptians were not circumcised. And Moses was circumcised, and so she probably looked down and says, aha, it's a Hebrew. That's the easiest answer to me right there. Now, Miriam, as she observes the daughter of Pharaoh oohing and aahing over that little baby, when Miriam saw that, she figured the princess was going to raise the child as her own. And so she runs out and says, hey, I got a nurse for you. Of course, she's thinking about her mother, Jochebed. When did Miriam conceive the plan that Moses' true mother would be the nurse? Well, I've already said I think that Jochebed's already figured this out before she even put Moses out on the water. So I believe that Miriam's mother had already given her the idea. It could have been that she comes up with the idea at the time that Moses was put into the reeds by her mother. And then Miriam says, maybe somebody pick this baby up and adopt him. Or it could be when it was surprise, surprise, the Pharaoh's daughter's out here bathing and sees Moses. I don't think so. I think it was planned from the very beginning. But however, whenever the idea occurred to her mind, to Miriam's mind, to hire Jochebed as a nurse, Amram and Jochebed's faith ended up being richly rewarded because Moses was saved and he became a big shot in Egypt. And verse 9, when it says, Pharaoh's daughter said to her, that's said to Jochebed, the mother, not to Miriam, because then Pharaoh's daughter says, I will give you your wages, referring to Miriam. So we go down to verse 10, Exodus 2. The child grew, and she, that's Jochebed, brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her, Pharaoh's daughter's son. So he was apparently adopted, Moses, and she, Pharaoh's daughter, named him Moses and said, because I drew him out of the water. Now, in the midst of all these feminine pronouns, the NIV Study Bible has made the observation that all of Pharaoh's efforts in the first part of Exodus were thwarted by women. And that's an interesting comment. Let's look at that. Exodus 1:17. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. So the Pharaoh's desire to kill the firstborn Hebrew sons was thwarted by the midwives, who were women. Two verses later, Exodus 1, the midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, they are vigorous and give birth, so we can't get to them to kill them. So that's midwives thwarting Pharaoh. And then here in Exodus 2, Moses' mother thwarts the Pharaoh's desire to kill her son, her male son. But when she, that's Moses' mother, Jochebed, could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket and covered it over with tar and pitch. We just read that. So Jochebed helped fox the Pharaoh, and then Miriam herself, in the passage which we just read, she foxed the Pharaoh because she's got the Pharaoh's daughter now raising up a Hebrew son right in the Pharaoh's palace, despite what the Pharaoh wanted. And then, of course, Pharaoh's daughter herself helped thwart Pharaoh's evil desire to kill the male Hebrew sons because she adopted one of them and raised him up. The NIV Study Bible looks at this and concludes that it is ironic that a strong Pharaoh, a Pharaoh is strong, is a king, a mighty Pharaoh, is being thwarted by women. This reminds me of the story of the Emperor Justinian, who ruled in the Byzantine Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire, between the years 527 and 565. He had a beloved wife, Theodora, who he apparently got along with very well. I don't think he had any concubines that I remember, and he seemed to get along with her very well, and she was raised by him up to a level of a lot of power in the empire. She was the empress, and Justinian decided he was going to go after some Monophysites. Justinian was Chalcedonian, Orthodox. His wife was not. And so as soon as he condemned several of them by name, she took those that he condemned and hid them in his own palace in Constantinople. And so, hi, honey. She sees him and she goes by there. She's hiding heretics right there in the castle. So these people that say that women don't have power, just because you don't have legal power doesn't mean that you can't do a lot of stuff if you're a woman. Now, Pharaoh's daughter named the baby Moses. The NIV Study Bible says the name has an Egyptian origin and it means is born. And then the NIV Study Bible says the Egyptian word Moses sounds like the Hebrew word for draw out because he was drawn from the reeds. And Hebrew and Egyptian are sort of close in their language and the words sometimes are close. And so even though the name was Egyptian, Moses, it was close to the Hebrew, which means draw out. And so somehow the Egyptian and the Hebrew got mixed up there, and she named that baby an Egyptian word that sounds like the Hebrew word for draw out. I don't know if she did that on purpose or it just ended up that way. But at any rate, as the NIV Study Bible says, every time Moses' name is spoken after the Exodus, it must have reminded people of the passage to the Red Sea because they were drawn out of the Red Sea just like Moses was drawn out of the Nile. I just finished saying that I didn't know whether Pharaoh's daughter knew any Hebrew. John Gill suggests that she must have known some. That's why she named the baby with an Egyptian word that sounds like a Hebrew word that means to draw out. Because she said, because I drew him out of the Nile. So she might have said, okay, I know what the Egyptian word for draw out is. And even though I know what the Hebrew word for draw out is, and even though I'm Egyptian, I know that Moses is the baby is a Hebrew, so I'll give him a Hebrew name that means draw out. I think that's probably what happened. I think Gill's probably right about that. Now, Adam Clark points out that what Moses' original name given him by his parents was, what that name was, it's lost to history. We don't know. We go down to Exodus 2, verses 11 and 12. Now, it came about in those days when Moses had grown up that he went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that, and when he saw there was no one around, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. Now when he had grown up, he was about 40 years old. We know that from Stephen and his speech before the Sanhedrin members who were stoning him to death, getting ready to kill him. Acts 7:23. But when he, Moses, was approaching the age of 40, it entered his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel. Now I don't know how Stephen knows all this. I'm not quite exactly sure. But at any rate, we'll take Stephen's word for it, that he was about 40. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. Now, that was probably one of the Egyptian taskmasters who was put in charge of the Hebrew slaves. Now, it says he's beating this Hebrew slave. The beating, that's a little bit mild. He's probably getting ready to kill him. Let's read on with what Stephen said in Acts 7. starting at verse 24. And when he saw one of them being treated unjustly, Moses did. Moses defended him and took vengeance for the oppressed by striking down the Egyptian. And he supposed that his brethren understood that God was granting them deliverance through him, but they did not understand. On the following day he appeared to them as they were fighting together, and he tried to reconcile them in peace, saying, "Men, you are brethren, why do you injure one another?" But the one who was injuring his neighbor pushed him away, saying, "Who made you a ruler and judge over us? You do not mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday, do you?" At this remark, Moses fled and became an alien in the land of Midian, where he became the father of two sons. Well, that anticipates what we're going to be reading here in Exodus, but it doesn't really prove that Moses killed, that the Egyptian who was beating the Hebrew slave killed the Hebrew slave, but I suspect it was. Let's read Hebrews 11, 24 through 27 to get some more background of the story we're about to read. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Now, some say that Pharaoh's daughter proposed to make him successor to the throne, and Moses refused that. In other words, he didn't just refuse to be the Pharaoh's daughter anymore. He actually refused to be Pharaoh himself. Whoa. Choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen. So we see now that we're going to start examining Moses' walk of faith in his very, very unusual life. Now in verse 11, Moses sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. Would Moses know that the Hebrew slave was one of his brethren? Would Moses know that he himself was a Hebrew? He was raised an Egyptian his whole life. Why would he think that he was a Hebrew? Well, his mother slash nurse no doubt had told him as he was growing up, "You're not really an Egyptian, son. You're a Hebrew." So I'm sure he knew that. And so that's one reason why he tried to defend that Hebrew slave who was getting beaten, probably beaten to death, by the taskmaster. Now Moses struck down the Egyptian, as we see in verse 12. Then NIV says, killed him, which obviously is what he did. Now the question is, was Moses' killing of that Egyptian justified? Well, at first read, I always thought that it was not justified, but as I just said, the Egyptian had probably killed the Hebrew and was in the process of killing the Hebrew when Moses came upon them. So if that's true, then on principle, in effect, since Noah killed a murderer, this was punishment for murderer. It was more judicial rather than emotional, personal revenge. Moses had to kill that Egyptian if he was going to save the life of the Hebrews. So Moses was acting to protect the innocent. So now, if you look at it that way, Moses' killing was justified, and instead of being a bad guy, he was a good guy. And we also notice that that killing is never condemned in Scripture, so I think the benefit of the doubt should go to Moses that it was an innocent, justified homicide here, a police action, if you will. It was not Moses committing manslaughter or murder or something like that. It was a justifiable homicide, in my opinion. We go now to Exodus 2, verses 13 through 14. He, that's Moses, went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrews were fighting with each other, and he said to the offender, "Why are you striking your companion?" But he, the offender, said, "Who made you a prince or judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" One day later, and the news is already out, Moses has killed an Egyptian. Ooh, now you can imagine what people thought. One of their taskmasters has been killed by a high-level Egyptian official. They probably didn't know that he was a Hebrew Egyptian official, but still, I'm sure that was big news. He got out. Then Moses was afraid, the scripture continues in verse 14. Then Moses was afraid and said, "Surely the matter has become known." Yes, it had. It had become known. Now, when Moses came upon the two Hebrews fighting and said, "Why are you striking your companion?" He was trying to be a peacemaker, a mediator. And look how he got rewarded for it. He ended up being an exile in Midian because of it, lost all of his high position in Egypt. This reminds me of a proverb, Proverbs 26:17. A person who is passing by and meddles in a quarrel that's not his is like one who grabs a dog by the ears. You grab a dog by the ears, oh, there's going to be some blowback. That dog's going to, when he gets the chance, he's going to bite you and tear you and scream and holler and so forth. And so generally you want to stay out of other people's business. But again, if you can, but on the other hand, sometimes you need a peacemaker. I don't know how to balance that off. What if that innocent Hebrew was about to get killed by the offending Hebrew? what's the difference there than what Joseph did with the innocent Hebrew slave that was getting beaten up by the Hebrew taskmaster? I don't see much difference. But at any rate, let's put it this way. According to that proverb, you interfere and try to make peace in other people's business, it's a dangerous proposition. Dangerous proposition. And more often than not, you need to stay out of it. I guess unless somebody's about to die, you need to get involved. But if they can work it out themselves, let them work it out. It's not your business. Who made you a prince and a judge over us? The offending Hebrew says. Now, ironically, Moses did become a prince and a judge 40 years later, as the NIV Study Bible points out. If we go back to Stephen's speech recounting all this in Acts 7:35, Stephen says this, "This Moses whom they disowned, saying, 'Who made you a ruler and a judge?'" That's the phrase I just quoted from by this offending Hebrew. "Who made you a ruler and a judge is the one whom God sent to be both a ruler and a deliverer with the help of the angel who appeared to him in the thorn bush." The angel in the thorn bush we'll see in just a minute. But the ruler and a deliverer, that judge, is not the sense of a guy in a black robe passing out sentences, but a judge in the sense of a deliverer, like in the book of Judges. So Stephen says, God has sent Moses to be a ruler, a leader, and one who delivers, a deliverer, that kind of judge. NIV Study Bible makes that point. Now, Stephen says that this offended Hebrew person did disown Moses' leadership. He said, you're not my leader and judge. In effect, he said that. But it was true. He was true in one sense that no one had ever appointed Moses to any leadership position. He was right. He disowned Moses as a leader, but he was correct in pointing out that no one had ever made him a leader. Well, if Moses thought he was going to be a leader at this time, those thoughts were quickly abused. He was quickly disabused from those thoughts. He knows leadership of these people? It's not going to happen. But 40 years later, in God's timing, it did happen. Moses was 80 by the time, incidentally, by the time of the Exodus, and he's 40 now. So 40 years later, he became the leader that took them out of the Exodus. Now, in verse 14, the scripture says, Moses was afraid and said, surely the matter has become known. He was afraid. Now, some people say, well, if he was afraid, how do you reconcile that with Hebrews 11:27? By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen. Well, that's not a contradiction. As John Gill says it, there's two different times. When Moses was 40, he was scared to death. When he was 80, he was full of faith, full of power, and went up and argued with the Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and says, let my people go. He was incredibly strong and courageous. In Hebrews chapter 11, verse 27, the author says, by faith he left Egypt. He's not talking about leaving Egypt to go to Midian, which he's about to do. He's talking about leaving Egypt permanently on the Exodus 40 years later. Now, the word had gotten out that Moses had killed that Hebrew taskmaster, and Moses said, oh, surely the word's gotten out. Well, how did that happen? Well, perhaps someone had seen Moses do the killing, even though Moses looked to the left and looked to the right. But Moses was careful. I don't think anybody saw it. The other option is that the Hebrew that Moses had saved had talked about it. Says, oh, this Egyptian official, da-da-da-da-da, his name is Moses. He saved my life. Maybe he inadvertently got Moses in trouble. We go down to verse 15, Exodus 2. When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Now this Pharaoh, the NIV Study Bible speculates, is probably, they say, Thutmose III, but nobody knows. I've gotten tired of trying to nail down which Pharaoh is which in the Bible. I spent a lot of time listening to Egyptian podcasts, get familiar with these guys. I've forgotten all of them now. And so I just don't know. We're just going to call him Pharaoh. He tried to kill Moses. Now, Moses had become a man of the court. And so it was a very serious thing to encourage slaves, because a slave revolt could be right around the corner. And slave revolts are very, very serious. And especially when you encourage slaves by killing an Egyptian official. No wonder that he was mad. And so, of course, he tried to kill Moses, and Moses fled. Now, if Moses thought he was going to lead the Israelites at the time of the killing, he was dead wrong. Not going to be for another 40 years. Now, the land of Midian was named after one of Abraham's younger sons, as the NIV Study Bible points out. Remember, Abraham had another wife named Keturah. Genesis 25:2, another wife besides Sarah. She's not well known, Keturah, but in Genesis 25, verse 2, she, Keturah, bore to him Zimran and Jokshan and Medan and Midian. and Ishbak and Shua. Midian is one of the sons of Keturah. Now, where is Midian? Well, if you'll look at a map and find the Sinai Peninsula, the Sinai Peninsula is made up of, is surrounded by the two branches of the Red Sea that split right there at the northern tip of the Red Sea. The western branch is called the Suez Gulf. The eastern branch is called the Gulf of Aqaba. And the Sinai Peninsula is right in between the Gulf of Suez and the Gulf of Aqaba. Now, at the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, in modern-day Israel, that's the very southern point of Israel. Their town of Eilat is there. It's a vacation place now for Israel. You go east a little bit and cross customs. You're into Jordan, and they have a town up there at the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, too. I've been there. Forgot the name of the Jordanian town, but I remember going through customs there. And as you're there at Eilat, at the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, you can look to the east and see it's basically the Saudi Arabian Peninsula and the southern end of Jordan. And to your west is the land of Egypt, the Sinai Peninsula. Now, Midian is on both sides there of the Gulf of Aqaba, right where I was. I didn't know it at the time that I was looking at Midian, but if I looked out my window and looked to the east, there's the water, the Gulf of Aqaba, and then there's these cliffs, high sandstone, red cliffs, flat kind of, or steep, very high and steep, not like mountains, but steep cliffs, and then they leveled off on a plain on the other side, and it went as far as the eye could see, and that was the land of Midian on both sides of the Gulf of Aqaba. So in the Sinai Peninsula, and also on the other side of the Sinai Peninsula, outside of the Sinai Peninsula, in the Arabian Peninsula, where Saudi Arabia is today, that's Midian. Now, the place is described as being dry and desolate. I can tell you from personal experience, it's beyond dry and desolate. That is the worst looking place. It reminds me of Mars. I'd rather live on Mars than live in that place. It's so bad. Now, this was a harsh and stark contrast to Moses' royal life that he had before. He had to spend 40 years there. And then, of course, after he got out of Midian, he spent 40 years in the wilderness, the Sinai wilderness, or wherever he was, and we're not exactly sure, but for 40 years they wandered around. Maybe it was at Kadesh Barnea, a little bit further to the north, but the point is he spent 40 more years in the wilderness for a total of 80 years in the wilderness. What a life this man had. So Moses goes to Midian, and he sits down at the well. Now, a well is a watering hole where everyone sits in the public. It's a public gathering place. This was common in that culture back then. Remember, Jesus met the Samaritan woman at the well. Remember, Abraham's servant Eliezer met all the people at probably Haran. And also, Jacob did the same thing when he went to Haran, sat down at the well. So this was understandable. We read in verse 16 and 17 of Exodus 2, "Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock." Verse 17, "Then the shepherds came and drove them," that's the sheep, "away. But Moses stood up and helped them," not the sheep, but helped the seven daughters, "and watered there the seven daughters' flock." Now this priest of Midian, who had seven daughters that show up at the well in Midian there, his name is Reuel. Reuel means friend of God. We see that down in verse 18. That'll be shortly, next verse. Reuel means friend of God. He also had another name in Exodus 3:1. We see that he was also named Jethro. Now, that sounds like somebody from the Beverly Hillbillies, but actually, Jethro may be a title meaning His Excellency, according to the NIV Study Bible. Now, here are some options as to who he was the priest of, or what does it mean, priest. He could have been a priest of the true God, Jethro being a descendant of Abraham. John Gill suggests that. Or it could be he wasn't a priest at all, because the word that's used for priest there is sometimes used of a prince, a ruler, or a governor, as John Gill and Adam Clark say. I'm just going to assume he was a priest. Well, I don't know why he couldn't be a pagan priest, a priest of a pagan god. I don't know. If he was, then Moses married into a pagan family. That's a no-no. So maybe he wasn't a priest of a pagan god. Now, one of those seven daughters was named Zipporah, and Zipporah was one whom Moses later married. So there's a little bit of romance in this chance encounter. Now, Adam Clark here's got a humorous quote about the daughters who let their sheep get driven away. Quote, "King's daughters performed the office of the laundress to their families, and the daughters of princes tended and watered the flocks." So Reuel was some kind of a prince, some kind of a big shot in Midian, and he had his daughters watering the flocks. Now this is what Clark says about such high-born daughters. "We have seen similar instances in the case of Rebekah and Rachel, and we cannot be too pointed in calling the attention of modern delicate females who were not only above serving their own parents and family, but even their own selves, the consequence of which is they have neither vigor nor health. Their growth, for want of healthy exercise, is generally cramped. Their natural powers are prematurely developed, and their whole course is rather an apology for living than a state of effective life. Many of these live not out half their days, and their offspring, when they have any, is more feeble than themselves, so that the race of man where such preposterous conduct is followed, and where is it not followed, is in a state of gradual deterioration. Ooh. So mamas, when you got daughters, you better let them exercise. Don't let them get soft. Now, what happened here in verse 17 to the seven daughters' sheep? Apparently, the girls drew the water, put the water in the troughs, and the sheep were about to start drinking, and then the nasty shepherds came up and drove their sheep off and let their sheep drink the water that the girls had labored to draw. So these people were thugs. This is Adam Clark's suggestion. I think that's exactly what happened. So once again, Moses tries to be a mediator. This time the result's a little bit happier. He gets married instead of gets banished from Egypt. Now Moses stood up and challenged these shepherds. He was outnumbered. Why didn't the shepherds fight back? Well, John Gill says shepherds aren't usually fighters. One thing to pick on seven girls, another thing to pick on Moses. Because Moses was a man of eminence and authority. He was raised in the court of Pharaoh, and he was probably big enough and strong enough and authoritative enough to where they got scared and they didn't fight him back. And it could be they had a guilty conscience because they knew they were in the wrong. Of course, they had just stolen seven girls' water for their sheep and so for her sheep. And so if it push came to shove and they ended up in a lawsuit at the gate of some city somewhere, they were going to lose. So for whatever reason, they didn't fight back. We go now to Exodus chapter 2, verses 18 through 20. When they came to rule their father, the seven daughters came to rule their father, Reuel, also known as Jethro. He, Reuel, said, "Why have you come back to so soon today?" So they said, "An Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds. And what is more, he even drew the water for us and watered the flock." Reuel said to his daughters, "Where is he then? Why is it that you have left the man behind? Invite him to have something to eat." Now, why did the daughters come back soon? Probably because Moses had helped them, and he did the job quickly, and the daughters got the sheep watered quickly, and they came back soon. The daughters identified Moses as an Egyptian because Moses, born and bred in Egypt, sounded and looked like an Egyptian. And it's ironic the Savior of the Jews would appear to be an Egyptian, is it not? And Reuel, also known as Jethro, asked his daughters, "Where is he?" The story about Moses apparently excited Reuel's interest. Reuel, also known as Jethro, must have figured that Moses must be a man of unusual character to stand up for seven innocent girls at the well and run off those nasty shepherds. We go now to Exodus 2, verses 21 and 22. Moses was willing to dwell with the man. So obviously it's more than just a meal. He actually ended up living there and actually married Zipporah. Moses was willing to dwell with the man, and Reuel gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses. Then she gave birth to a son, and he named him Gershom, for he said, "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land." Of course, this giving of the daughter Zipporah to Moses didn't happen that night as they sat down to supper. Time has gone by, which is not mentioned. Many think that this wasn't a pure gift of Zipporah to Moses, that Moses had actually worked for Reuel, perhaps tending sheep, and as a result, in return for that, he got Zipporah, just like Jacob worked for Leah and Rachel. We read in Exodus 3:1, "Now Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God." So Moses was pasturing for Reuel, and he probably got Zipporah as a reward. The word Zipporah means a little bird. So he was married to a little bird, and then Zipporah gave him a son. The son's name was Gershom. Now Gershom means a desolate stranger. Why would Moses name his son a desolate stranger? Well, Gill has three options. One, he's complaining because Moses is a desolate stranger living in the land of Midian. Or he's thankful to God for providing him so well in the wilderness of Midian. "I'm a desolate stranger in Midian, but look at here. God has provided me with employment and a wife." Or it could be that whenever Moses looked at desolate stranger, his son, Moses would be reminded that Midian was not his home, but Canaan was the promised land. That's where his home was. So every time he would see his son, he would think, "I'm a desolate stranger down here in Midian. I'm not going to spend the rest of my life in Midian." He ended up spending 40 years there. And you can imagine after 40 years, you might be thinking, "Well, I'm going to die here in Midian." But every time he'd look at Gershom, he'd say, "No, Gershom, no, a desolate stranger. That's what I am." I tend to think that's what Moses was getting at when he named his son that. Exodus chapter 2, verses 23 through 25, we will continue. Now it came about in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died, and the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them. Now many days goes by. That leads the NIV Study Bible to say that that must be Thutmose III, because he reigned a long time. But again, we don't know who the Pharaoh was. King of Egypt is Pharaoh, by the way. Pharaoh is just another name for, I forgot what it means. It's an administrative title, something like the house of the king. I forgot what Pharaoh means, but it's not a proper name. It's a title. The sons of Israel, the slaves, they were crying out. They were groaning, and God heard that groaning. Note the providence of God here. If not for the Hebrews' slavery, they never would have left Egypt. It was hard enough leaving Egypt as it was. It took a lot of miracles to get them out. So if they hadn't been slaves, they never would have agreed to leave. They would have just sat there in wealth and prosperity in the richest lands of Egypt in Goshen and just gotten bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. But no, because they got run out of Egypt, they ended up establishing Israel in the promised land as God had promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And as a result, they created a home for the Messiah. And if they hadn't been driven out of Israel, if they had not become slaves, they would not have been left Israel. Israel would not have been established. The Messiah would not have been born, and we'd have all died and gone to hell. So it was a big deal that in the providence of God, they were slaves. God took the horrible slavery, bad thing, and turned it around to good. He established a nation there of Israel. So God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And of course, that covenant has been repeated so many times in the audios on Genesis. I'm going to briefly go through the covenant promises. First of all, the covenant with Abraham, Genesis 15, 17. What I'm going to do is I'm going to say covenant with Abraham, covenant with Isaac, and covenant with Jacob, the three patriarchs. Genesis, now we're talking about the covenant with Abraham, Genesis 15, 17, and 18. It came about when the sun had set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between these pieces. That's representing God. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, who was called Abram at the time, later changed to Abraham. Genesis 17:7, this is at the time of the establishment of circumcision. I will establish my covenant between me, that's God speaking, my covenant between me and you and your descendants. So the covenant was between Abram and the descendants. We go to Isaac, the first descendant, Genesis 17:19. But God said, no, but Sarah, your wife, will bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him. This is when, before Isaac was born, but it was already established that the covenant was going to be established with Isaac. We go to Genesis 26:24. The Lord appeared to him, to Isaac, the same night, and said, I am the God of your father, Abraham. Do not fear. I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants. There's the offspring promised. The covenant was renewed with Isaac. That was when Isaac left Gerar. Covenant with Jacob, Genesis, that's Isaac's son Jacob, Genesis 35:11-12, when God's trying to tell Jacob to go on down to Egypt, God also said to him, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply, a nation and company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall come forth from you, the land which I gave to Abraham and Isaac I will give to you, and I will give the land to your descendants after you. So that land promise, offspring promise, land, offspring, and blessings to the nation is given to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and their descendants, and Jacob's descendants. On it goes to the patriarchs. On that happy note, we have finished Exodus chapter 2. That prepares us for our next audio, which will cover Exodus 3, verses 1 through 22, the entire chapter. We will see Moses confronting Yahweh at the burning bush in Midian. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.